This is Ed Mazur, Chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our program today featured President Trump and the news media, and our participants included Greg Hines of Crane Chicago Business, Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times, head of the Washington Bureau, and Clarence Page, member of the Chicago Tribune editorial page board, and Tim Carney from the Washington Examiner. We had a very sprightly discussion for the people in the audience, talking about the role of the media and how it's changing, the question of facts and what are facts and how are they changing, and how will Mr. Trump in the coming months come to deal with the media. And the media is all over, so there's no way of escaping, was the conclusion of four of the participants. And so Mr. Trump is probably going to continue to tweet and Twitter, but he will be held in check increasingly as we focus on more policy issues than personality by the Congress, probably by the judiciary, and probably by the press and the media. And before the 2018 elections, such things as programs with Boeing aircraft, coal mining will be on the boards already, and this could have a tremendous effect on the electorate. The cast of characters with the media is changing, and the conclusion of the participants was that this makes it much harder for people to develop relationships, develop contacts, and the media has, you can't keep the media away from discussing the presidential administration. So we had a tremendous discussion today. Greg Hines is going to kick things off with a comment or two, and then we'll roll, and we've got tons of questions.
Well, I just wanted to underline at the beginning, before we get started here, that we have to be respectful of the ground rules. We wouldn't want anybody to go crazy with their tweets afterwards because the wrong thing was said. And the most important rule regards the treatment of your distinguished moderator. In the reportage after this event, including those tapes back there, Ed, you will kindly refer to the distinguished moderator as a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Now, when did Hines win the Pulitzer Prize, you might ask? I missed that. Well, my response is, you don't read Breitbart. And you don't watch Sean Hannity. Because if you did, you would know that it's a widely recognized fact that the Pulitzer Prize Committee is stacked with illegals who don't like certain kinds of journalists. And that if it was a real committee and they voted the right way, well, I'd have the Pulitzer, not just Mr. Dole over there. So you keep that in mind, because I wouldn't want to have to get out my Twitter finger after this event either, folks. All right. So, but my point is, if these folks can deal with me, they certainly can deal with the president, right? So let's get to it. I have a two-part question to kick this off. All politicians bloviate, exaggerate, preen, exaggerate the truth. Is Donald Trump really to any significant degree different than his predecessors? And either way, how do you deal with them? We'll just go straight across. Lynn, why don't you go first?
Thank you for the question. And as always, it's great to be back home. It's been a long climb from 6114 North Kimball Avenue, Dr. Mazur, to the seat today. But somehow I made it. My sister Nisa is here today. Thank you for being here. My boss Jim Kirk is here today. Thank you for being here. So, I have spent decades covering people who dissemble, lie by omission, lie by commission, shade the truth, dance with the truth, or try to finagle out of facts, or just try to talk you out of something. So, in short, I don't think this is news to you, but we are in new territory, dealing with a president and a lot of his staffers who can't even agree on a threshold set of facts. That's called a lie. Sometimes it's called fake news. But a lie is a lie. Even in basic elements of agreement, we see an administration not being able to talk about facts. President Trump either had evidence of wiretapping or did not, because he wrote in his tweet declaratively that he was tapped, wiretapped. Today was the day that the House Intelligence Committee was supposed to get evidence from the White House. I would be surprised. Maybe it happened by now, maybe not. But I know just from the interview that Counselor Kellyanne Conway gave this morning, it did not sound like there would be evidence, if by that we mean a fact, a document, a FISA application, a piece of paper, some element of fact. Without switching the subject, it's not there. So, yes, Craig, this is a new territory, and I think the challenge right now for all journalists is to how to figure out to navigate and cover at the same time. Because when you have buy-in from staff in this very unusual situation, it does make things worse. And a president has to have staff to deal with. The president has responsibility for what he says. And President Trump, from his morning tweets, which seem to be abating, to what he says about the day's events, often does not stand up to fact. But he has a budget to put out this week. Now will be a potential change, because when it comes to dealing with Congress, you can't just make up stuff in the way that the improvisation, if you want to be kind, of President Trump has been going on. So that's some of my opening thoughts. Big, deep change in how any president has ever acted. We could go into it more.
Clarence.
Thank you, Greg. I first of all, it is great to be back home, and it's a good thing, too, because my flight's just been canceled. and I've been rebooked for Wednesday morning to get back, so so I've got a wonderful excuse now to... I was thinking, you know, how'd you get through January and February without snow? I mean, didn't you really miss it, you know? And now I'm going to get my chance to experience it. So in any case... I've thought about that question quite a bit, Greg. I especially, after Sean Spicer's first, under what you would call it, it wasn't a news conference, it wasn't a news spray or a gaggle, but the first day after inauguration, you know, when he came and chewed out the reporters for reporting facts about the turnout of the crowd at the inauguration. And no, you all are all wrong. It was the biggest crowd ever assembled for anything. But I was reminded of the first Mayor Daley, or Richard the First, as some of us call him, who's a press secretary, one day chewed out the reporters saying, don't report what the mayor says, report what he means. Now, we've heard that a number of occasions now from Kellyanne and other folks in regard to President Trump, just in no different words, but there was that wonderful line from the campaign that one reporter, and her name slips my mind now, she might have been with
Selena
Examiner.
Zito.
You know what I'm talking about,
Selena,
right?
Selena Zito.
Right, exactly. That we in the media reported or covered what we took the candidate Trump literally, but not, I'm sorry, seriously, but not literally.
Well, we took him seriously, literally, but not seriously. But his supporters took him
seriously, but not literally. There you go. You followed that, right? But this is kind of where we are now with, I thought about this the other day when Sean Spicer was asked about if President Trump believes the jobless statistics now, that they show, once again, a decrease in unemployment, only this time under President Trump. And he said essentially, the figures weren't accurate before, but they're real now. And everybody laughed. There was a sort of a rapport between Spicer and the reporters, which is kind of a rare moment these days, but there was that moment when everybody laughed. That reminded me of the City Hall press room once again, back when people were laughing about the crazy absurdities that we all love about Chicago politics. I've seen other leaders who were not President of the United States that had this kind of a relationship with the press and with facts and all. Nowadays, I have to go overseas to some various despots around the planet to find anything comparable. Masha Gessen is a Russian-American dissident journalist who wrote a wonderful book on Vladimir Putin, and she wasn't that well known outside of Soviet journalism circle, or I should say people who are Russophiles as far as their journalism that they turn to are concerned. But now, with the rise of Trump, she's been asked a lot about comparisons between the two, and she wrote a piece for the New York Review of Books last year that compared the two of them. It's gone viral on the web. And she also wrote a piece later on about how to cover a despot, and it was advice to her fellow journalists. And it's very intriguing. Number one was, when the despot tells you who they are, believe them. And I thought about that when I hear so many people, including Trump voters, who say, well, I never thought he was really going to do those things he was saying he would do. And that's why Gessen said that, because she hears that in various regimes. And in my role on the board of the Committee to Protect Journalists, I've been around to various despot regimes trying to do something to help press freedom from Cuba to Zimbabwe. And I've seen the same kind of behavior. There's a certain kind of a boss mentality that strikes both leaders and the people who support that leader that enables despotism to move in. I don't want to sound alarmist about the United States, because one nice thing about this country is its institutions are still strong. Although Masha Gessen's rule number four, I think it was, don't trust your institutions. don't put too much faith in them, because nobody expected Putin to take over the media in his country in 2 years, but he did it. He's taken over other major institutions as well. And so we have a certain reflex in the media about certain kinds of behavior by people in power, and those reflexes are tingling now with Trump in office. But I think, I mean, I notice how, for one thing, the first time he was blocked was by the courts over immigration. And then he's also frustrated by leaks. Imagine that, leaks in Washington. But leaks are also a check on power. They're being demonized now by some folks as the dark state. But the fact is that we've always had a middle-level people who have used leaks one way or another, either for their personal gain or in order to send a message to the top of the bureaucracy, or a way of providing some kind of a check on runaway power as they see it. So all of a sudden, we are now having those kind of debates in the country. So that's my long-winded answer to your question.
Okay, let's keep it short-winded.
All right.
Tim Carney.
Thank you. Thank you again. This is my first time coming to the City Club. I'm very grateful. I'm grateful, as always, to Lynn, who, working with my mentor, Bob Novak, for years, has been something of a mentor to me. In my coat pocket, I have a couple of pencils that are always in my coat pocket, because it was Lynn who told me, if you're outside doing reporting and it's a cold day, the ink on your pen is going to dry up. I was a 26-year-old reporter when she told me that, so I always have these pencils, and in Chicago, I think it's especially useful. I have a flight booked for 4 p.m. today, and waiting for it to be canceled, but you know, pray for me and pray for my wife, who's home with six kids on her birthday. So. Covering Donald Trump is harder than covering Barack Obama for a couple reasons. One, I agree basically almost with everything Lynn and Clarence said about the sort of looser relationship with the truth, is a euphemistic way to put it. The inability to sort of have agreement with the staff, so you ask a question of a spokesman and it might not be what, you know, his or her boss would say. But one reason that covering Trump is harder is because, from my perspective, our commentary page, we're conservative, we've been very critical of Trump, but we find that now, when we're reporting out our news page or commentary page, sort of the problems and the conflicts of Donald Trump, we have a lot more competition from the media than we did when we were reporting the misdeeds of Barack Obama. That is to say, covering Trump is harder because the rest of the media has kind of woken up to its job after 8 years of slumber. What we had... What's the New York Times new motto? The truth is more important now than ever. So if we're to take New York Times literally and seriously, they're saying the truth was a little less important before January 20th for the past 8 years. And we saw it. I mean, I'll just a couple of my main beat under Obama was covering lobbying and the intersection of business and government. So things that I stumbled across there, Barack Obama in his first State of the Union address said, we have excluded lobbyists from policy-making jobs. I put out a list of 30 lobbyists that he had hired in policy-making jobs. I called the White House. They got back to me the next day. I was the only reporter who asked them this question. I said, why did the president say that? You haven't excluded all lobbyists. I said, you're misquoting the president. He didn't say we have excluded all lobbyists. He said, we have excluded lobbyists, and here's a list of some lobbyists who we excluded from jobs. Nobody else picked up that story at the time. Obama had this revolving door rule. H&R Block's CEO came in. Obama hired H&R Block CEO to rewrite rules on tax preparers in a way that H&R Block favored. That didn't get reported anywhere else. You haven't heard these stories unless you were reading the Washington Examiner. Andrew McLaughlin was Google's top lobbyist. He got a job at in the White House. He communicated with Google lobbyists to advance policies Google liked. Clear violation of ethical standards. He got chastised by the White House. He got disciplined only after we reported on it, on these emails that had been published by a FOIA. We didn't do the FOIA. The FOIA was put out there by a nonprofit. I was the only one who went through the emails with the eye to, I wonder if Google worked with the White House on this. I could go on with stories and stories about this. The fact is that the media now is, I think I misused this word, but the word's going around these days. The media is suddenly woke. It was sleeping for 8 years, and now it woke up. But not only so, now it is doing what it's supposed to be doing. But I'll comment later. Sometimes when you wake up from a slumber and you've been sleeping a lot, you're sort of disoriented. I think especially the transition in the first month of the Trump administration, we had a disoriented media that misshot, that was over-aggressive and didn't do what we're supposed to do. And Jack Schaefer at Politico put it very well. He said all this, oh, now is the time for us to be warriors and do our job talk in the media. Forgot what Jack Schaefer said. No, now is the time for us to do what we're supposed to do, which is soberly double-check all our facts. If you want, I could go through a dozen examples of the media not doing that. So I think covering Trump is harder because he's not as careful with the facts. He doesn't seem to care about the facts as much as previous politicians, even ones who would mislead us, like George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, etc. But it's also harder because the rest of the media doesn't have the sobriety it should have to make sure it's getting the story right.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Tim. Greg?
I'm going to answer my own question, and then I'm going to throw one back to y'all. I agree with Lynn. I think there's a qualitative difference between this administration and prior ones. I'll just mention two things that this president has said so far with a straight face. One, Hillary Clinton didn't win that popular vote. I won the popular vote. It's all those illegals. Where's the proof? Well, this is a report. Somebody said there were 50 people in Omaha who voted 5 years ago. That goes to the core legitimacy of this president. To some degree, who really got more votes and who didn't. I don't think anybody's disputed that he got more electoral votes, but popular votes, to say that the results aren't what they are is something I've not heard another president say. And then there's, I'll mention one other one, this most recent contretemps about Barack Obama had me wiretapped in the tower. They didn't say, well, they had a wiretap on somebody, and they called into the tower one day, and one of my guys got picked up. It's Barack Obama himself ordered. No proof, none. In an ordinary court of law, that would be called slander. It is slander. I've not heard that kind of thing from another president of the United States. That having been said, we do indeed live in a weird world where some recent stories I've read virtually say in the lead, President Trump lied again today when he said, the jarringness of the president said, and it's absolutely wrong when he said it. I wonder, and this is the question I'm going to pose back to you, are we walking into the trap? This president probably figures that the bulk of the media on policy reasons is going to be against him anyhow. So if he can get us to constantly say he's a liar, he's wrong, If he can get us to ignore policy things and go for the glitzy kind of, oh, he said what in a tweet? Are we missing the story? Are we hurting ourselves? Anybody?
I'll say yes. I mean, yeah, I think we are. I mean, again, there's stories there. I mean, you all know what he said about the wiretaps. To me, again, Clarence put the quote of my colleague Selena Zito taking him literally being a mistake. I don't think he's lying. I think the guy doesn't know what he's talking about, and he speaks without any information. Okay, there's in Catholic. I'm a Catholic, and in our moral teaching, we have this idea. You know, my son is 8, and he's going to go to. He went to his first confession, and before that point, when you're like 6 and you do something, well, he's not at the age of reason, so you're not culpable. Sometimes I feel we have a president who hasn't reached the age of reason, and he's not culpable. This is not a defense of him. I voted against Donald Trump, so we're kind of chasing. I mean, if you were fact checking my 6-year-old, would you be spending your time very well? No. Meanwhile, how many of you know that he sold a condo in Manhattan? To a Chinese businesswoman who markets her business as basically selling access to people with power for a few million dollars. That's kind of important. The largest bank in the world is a state-owned Chinese bank, and they are a tenant at Trump Tower, a different building. These are the sort of conflicts of interest that I think don't get covered enough because we're busy chasing what his latest tweet is, because we're treating him the way we would, you know, we're fact-checking him literally as opposed to looking at what's going on behind there. So that's one of my ways in which I think he is sort of leading us around.
Well, it's a shock to my system as a journalist to find, you know, after years of being dogged by editors who want me to check everything out, you know, the good old City News Bureau style, if your mother says she loves you, check it out, that all of a sudden facts don't, you know, I think it's too simplistic to say facts don't mean anything to this president. When I heard him respond to Hugh Hewitt asking him about his views on the nuclear triad, I could tell by his answer he sounded just like I sounded in high school when I hadn't prepared for the oral exam, because he was BSing his way from one end to the other, and he didn't stop. He insisted even on adding to it after Hugh kind of was about to give him a break. But this is that's one thing. But what intrigues me more than his casual relationship to facts is that how easily he gets away with it, and why. And so then I've got to look. Well, you know, here's a man who was elected by people who, in large part, said, "I'm tired of conventional politicians. I'm tired of people who've spent all their lives in government. I want somebody from outside. Maybe a businessman can come in and straighten everything out." Now, I've been around long enough to know business and government are two very different things. The whole set of motivations is entirely different. There's a profit motive on one side and a public service motive on the other. I've had a hard time trying to find something in Donald Trump's background that tells me he's interested in public service. The closest was that project he did in New York with the city, that park project.
The skating rink.
The skating rink, yeah. It was an excellent job, came in under budget, et cetera. And, you know, that's where, you know, that gives the business community a good name, you know, business leadership a good name, and that whole model. We have now folks who have already lost their faith and trust in the system, in the establishment folks. And some of you who are regular followers of my column, and I know you all are because that's such an intelligent group. You know, I come from Middletown, Ohio, the same town as J.D. Vance of Hillbilly Elegy, which when I was growing up was an all-American city back in the 50s. And now Forbes magazine has it among the top 10 fastest dying cities in America. And when I was wondering why Trump was leading before the election in the polls in Ohio, where I grew up, I went back and started checking it out. And I realized that post-industrial decay, this is the kind of place where you find the folks that Trump was reaching out to and very successfully.
Clarence, are you saying essentially that not only does Trump's base not care if he appears to be a liar, in some ways they actually like it because it makes him look like a big fighter for them?
Absolutely. It's a cultural thing. You know, it's like, I've had Trump supporters tell me, and my hometown in John Boehner's district, Middletown, Ohio, Trump won overwhelmingly. Republicans always do, as far back as I can remember. But when I asked them, well, you think he's really going to open the coal mines back up again? You know, you think he's really going to build that big wall, et cetera, and he's really going to stop all the... I said, no, but, you know, he's talking about the right issues.
Lynn, what do you think about this?
Well, I want to parse your question. When you said, are we falling into a trap? Yes in part, no in part. I respectfully disagree with Mr. Carney, who gave... Yes. Yeah, there is a trap. Someday, some story, some ways, we might be into what you call the trap of overcoverage. But there is so much coverage now on the presidency, so much coverage on Trump, so much of beefing up White House coverage by major outlets who have an enormous amount of reach and resources that I think that we need to maybe ask another question, which is, are we being able to report on lies, falsehoods, and obfuscations as well as policy and politics? And the answer is yes, and people are doing it more. And for the moment, let me not get into what happened the previous 8 years, just to keep this conversation a little bit manageable. One of the things that will happen within a few days, within a few months, is not delivery of accomplishments in terms of a proclamation, but in terms of what makes sense in your real life. So maybe Boeing will in some way end up charging less for Air Force One than whatever were some estimates. By the way, we will not know that until Trump is out of office, even if he gets reelected. Okay, that is just not knowable yet. Or will, when you talk about Obamacare, this is what I hope everybody does, because you could test yourselves of people you know, yourself, your family, if these changes go through. Trump in January said health care will be far less expensive and far better. Now, whether you get your plans through your employer, whether you bought it on an insurance exchange, whether or not you're on Medicaid, which was vastly expanded in Illinois under Obamacare, whether or not people in this audience run nursing homes or provide health services through hospitals, I heard the AMA is here, which is against it, this is a fact, which you don't need a lot of people to tell you of your own experience. If a coal mine opens, you will know that. So soon we will know whether or not the shrinkage of the federal government, which will be in Trump's spending plan that is unveiled this week, you'll know. If you have impact on things that mean something to you, and if these claims that things will be better for you, which brought in voters who thought a business executive who was selling himself as wildly successful, though we have known in story subsequent that's not the case, as Trump put it, will know soon. And one of the things I think will change a little bit as time goes on, maybe incremental, is that every day we get closer to the 2018 elections, where historically presidents in power have lost. You will know soon if the Republicans in Congress will put up some kind of resistance, and at least in the area of factual accuracy, because you can't write legislation with having some agreement and a basis in fact. Today's the day, supposedly, if it happened, I've been here, that the Obamacare replacement, Trump Care, and this is not my joke, it's somebody else's, but it's so good I want to tell you, this is, the Republicans aren't calling it Trump Care. Who ever heard of something that Trump didn't want to put his name on?
Okay, can we get to some of the questions now? Thank you, Lynn. Thank you. And panelists, when you respond to... Greg's questions, try to keep it as brief and succinct as possible because we have a ton of questions here.
We do have a ton of questions. The first one comes from, is it Stella Black? City Club member. And I'm going to expand that a little bit. She asks about Mr. Bannon and his influence with the president. I'm going to broaden that out a little bit. You guys in Washington know a lot more about this than I do. You got Bannon. You got Spicer, you got the chief of staff who spins another way. When Trump speaks, or when the administration speaks, who is it that's really speaking? Who has the power? Tell us a little bit about that. Lift the veil.
So what Steve Bannon provided was something of a almost philosophical framework into which he told Trump that he fit. Now, this is not me with sort of super insider information, but watching it, knowing kind of Trump was speaking in these populist tones. I had a little echo of Ross Perot, of Pat Buchanan. More recently, Mike Huckabee and Rick Santorum were the ones who had a little bit of populism. And Bannon came in and he said, your instincts, Mr. Trump, of, you know, national sovereignty and the government should serve the people of the country and the game is rigged by the insiders in Washington against the little guy. There's a coherent philosophy that ties it all together. It's this national populism. And so Bannon created that sort of framework around him. And the speechwriter, Steve Miller, is of the same mind. So if you hear Trump say, and this is, by the way, in my view, a definitional truth, my job as president is to serve the American people, not other people. Immigration policy should serve the American people, not people who want to be Americans and aren't yet. Trade policy should serve the American people. All of those things that he says, that's coming from Bannon. Bannon's not deeply grounded in policy, so anything that's more policy-wise is coming from other people. But that's sort of the context I could provide there.
Guys, you have a different take?
I tend to agree.
Well, I think, you know, Sean Spicer, I know, has been caricatured wildly. And he's, once he's off camera, he's totally decent, very reasonable. He's been helpful to me. Off camera, Kellyanne Conway has been helpful. They have their perspective. But if you go to them out, you know, when you're with them, here's something I want to point out for all the mishigas about access that you might have read in the White House, that lower press and upper press, so these are the areas where the White House press secretary and the deputies sit and have their offices. It's adjacent to the briefing room. You could still go there and ask them questions. There's nowhere else in government where, once you get in, for the reporters who work in the briefing room, that you could just go actually find a PR person to talk to. Okay, you can't, in all the years I covered the East Wing, the First Lady's side, there you can't get to somebody just to ask somebody in person. Yeah, people often also obfuscate and omit. Another way, a classier way of lying is just to ignore phone calls and emails for months on end. You know, there are various ways to do it. I would just think maybe we could applaud the Trump administration for being more forward and obvious on it. So in terms of some bread and butter stuff, Spicer and his troops are accessible, and if it's a question that they can answer, they will try to. But what you see sometimes is the craziness of a briefing, which is just a small part, a tiny part of White House coverage. It's important, but it's just a small part of the whole job of covering the White House. For the people who are really there every day, there is access because they could walk in and still have questions. They could put questions to people. Whether or not you get them answered, roll of the dice. But I'll tell you, I deal with, and I know there are many communication people in the audience here, sometimes a polite way of saying F you is just to say, I'll get back to you.
Thank you, Lynn.
My kind of read on this is that when Trump speaks for his administration. I don't think there's too much doubt about that. But the longer he's there, the longer I suspect he'll find out that there's all kinds of stuff that he can't come up to speed on. He's having trouble coming up to speed on some of his big picture stuff. And Lynn was kind of referring to some of the vast empire that a president has to rule. I think there's already signs of some pretty good turf wars. Again, you Washington, guys in Washington would know that better than I do. But I'm not sure we quite yet know whether the Priebus moderates or the Bannon Miller zealots or some other force is going to emerge as the winner here.
I have another view on that, and that is if you have a president who does not come in as a subject specialist, hasn't shown much inclination to do those kind of deep dives, one of the techniques we've seen him use, and let me go back to Obamacare, is just to find somebody he agrees with, and then they do the heavy lift. So Recently, over the weekend, there were stories that Trump said that he's with the Paul Ryan plan. That's another way of saying, Paul, I'm with you. What's next? So when you say it that way, have you ever had some home repair and your guy is giving you, we could do this, we could do that, we could do it this way, and you say, you know what, if it's just going to cost me $1,000 no matter what, use your judgment, I trust you, and then you don't have to think for yourself anymore. So I think that means that there will be a rise in the influence of McConnell and Ryan, who I think Trump sees more as his deputy chiefs of staff, more than because they're in charge of operations. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, you know, I just counsel the internal White House policies may not be, as we see the next week's unfold in budgeting, as important as to how you see Trump deal with lawmakers who he will learn he cannot fire.
Interesting.
Okay, Greg?
We have a non-Trump question, but it has some Trump applicability. Comes from Jennifer Burrows. Please comment on the State Department's ban on the media going with Rex Tillerson to China, Korea, his first major trip this week. And she goes on to say, what action can the press take to rectify this? I'd add, is this the sign of the future? Is this the first of other kinds of areas in which, instead of bothering to lie to us, they just say you're not invited?
Lynn might be able to comment better on this. I think there's just been a steady march over the last few presidents of slowly dialing back access. And so what the normal thing on a lot of these trips is the State Department press, the people who cover the Secretary of State every day, would fly along with Rex Tillerson, and actually they would pay for it. And I never thought it was worth it, but you know, maybe you guys did at the Chicago Tribune, the Sun-Times, the New York Times, the Washington Post. They would shell out big money to send their reporters over to China or whatever. And so the federal government actually didn't lose money on it, and Rex Tillerson's answer was, oh, well, we decided to save money by not bringing the reporters along. So, I mean, that was another sort of slippery answer. But under Obama, we also saw sort of slowly making cabinet secretaries or different parts of the White House less and less accessible. So I do think it's sort of a sign of the future that we're going to slowly see reporters who are used to being able to go along on these things getting dialed out. But maybe I'm being pessimistic.
Well, Trump is constantly rewriting the rules and the ground rules on this, not just overseas trips, but in the White House, as we have seen. I'm not that familiar with this particular trip as far as the press policy is concerned, but I don't think it's going to last because maybe there's some belief here that they can keep things under wraps more by not by keeping the press at arm's length. But you can't get away from the press. We're everywhere. And we tend to, just by profession, whenever we're shut out of something, become just that much more curious about what's going on inside. You also, if you are denied access to official sources, then you're going to go to unofficial sources.
Yep.
And thus the newsmaker, the principal newsmaker in this case, Secretary of State, loses his ability to control the message.
And often this is an improvement, right? I mean,
right.
At Trump rallies, the reporters and Hillary Clinton rallies, the reporters would be kept in this little pen. And I realized at my first Trump rally when I saw that happening, I just went in the public thing, and I was able to see all sorts of stuff that most of the reporters couldn't see because they were kept in a pen. China's trickier, but I also know a lot of times you don't get official access. You end up hanging out in a stairwell, and you get a better story that way.
Right.
So I believe this is a loss for coverage because the big outfits that can afford these trips would probably have somebody on the ground anyway. To do those kinds of stories that you have described. You are losing the ability to interview in real time our Secretary of State to get our nation's perspective on what happened, who the meetings were with, what the bilateral was with. Now, the State Department is not staffed up. So even if reporters were on the plane, there's no deputy secretaries. There is an amazing number of
agencies. So he's hurting himself. He's losing an ability to spin.
Well, let's not use words like that. See, one of the things I want to try and do is to describe and explain more than put the value on it. Because reporters in a variety of levels who get information from an official government source is subject to spinning. Our job is to figure out what is newsworthy and what isn't. Just because it comes in a press release doesn't mean you shouldn't report it. So it's not a matter of spin. Sometimes it's the perspective, to use Mr. Carney's word, of we just had this bilateral meeting in Beijing. A reporter on the ground wouldn't physically be able to get into a place to even hear our side of the story. And one of the things that may happen then is that we hear what happened in a trilateral, bilat. We'll hear from the Brits, we'll hear from the Chinese press, and we won't hear from our side. And that's where I think you'll see the loss, because the big organizations with a lot of staff can do both. So not taking the reporters who cover, they really cover the Secretary of State, the ones who are there, the Andrea Mitchells of the world. And, you know, they would have a sit-down at some point in the trip to do a real-time debrief. That's the kind of coverage we may be losing. Now, Tillerson on the ground may have reporters in who does this type of interview if they get there, but you kind of lose something along the way in this.
I think that's a valid point, but I also think Tim makes a valid point when he says that the overall trend is not advantageous to those who want a free and open government. I mean, I noticed this locally where increasingly public officials won't answer questions. Even their press people won't answer right. Their questions. It's, well, let's go on background.
Well, and part of the thing, so again.
Which isn't the same because there's no direct responsibility.
Bob Novak was my boss, my mentor, great columnist, and he sometimes would muse about, I'd ask him, I'd say, why did that guy actually talk to you? I see why you called him, but why did he call you back? And he said, that sort of just used to be what they did, and I don't know that it was always in their interest to do this, to dish in this sort of way, except for the few people who were sort of masters of it, like LBJ. A lot of times these guys would get themselves in trouble over this. And he worried near the end of his career. He said, these guys are getting better. These politicians are getting more risk-averse, and they're getting better at their job if you understand their job not to be public servants but to be guys who want to get reelected. And when they understand that's their job and they get better at it, they realize that often it's in their interest to not answer, or anytime they answer, to give a non-answer. Do you think that's true?
Well, here's why it's so true. Now I deal with public officials from City Hall to, you know, Illinois State to our congressional delegation in the White House. Here is the troubling trend I see everywhere. When you deal with a so-called communications professional on their email now, no one puts phone numbers down because they don't want calls. They want to just limit a paper trail so they don't get in trouble, and then they control things. This yep. is when we talk about troubling developments, let's start there. How many communications government people are there? Okay.
A lot didn't raise their hand.
But my point is, one of the hardest questions some days I have is, what number are you at? Can we talk? Because I know that my emails are subject to FOIA. If I want to talk to someone, and there's reasons why you want to talk to somebody, because you're not going to get anywhere on an email. I could ask 9 questions or 90. You know, you're not going to get anywhere. And sometimes in the conversation, it could be more productive. Now, when you talk about Novak, when you have sources, when you have relationships, you can maybe have conversations. But when you're dealing with a new cast of characters, it's incredibly difficult sometimes to not only get a call returned, but to get numbers because there is resistance to giving it out. Okay, it used to be when you saw a press release, there'd be for more information call. It's not there. It's just an email.
Yeah, and sometimes even if you call that person, they say, it's not me. Yeah. I've had that
right.
all the
but
time
so,
at City Hall.
So when you talk about troubling trends in media, you could start locally and go all the way up.
A rare area where we all agree. Let's see if we can agree on this one. This comes from Dave Cullen. I'm going to paraphrase a little bit. He's essentially asking, how effective is Trump-style media bashing? This effort to denigrate mainstream news media. Is fake news? Is it working? And what do we do about it?
Well, if I could just say, I've been in this business since the 1860s, 1960s, and seems like the 1860s. But for the first time, I've had people stopping me on the street and saying, thank you for doing what you're doing. I mean, my God. Usually it's, you know, my it's you guys have got too many biases left or right, or I didn't get my newspaper delivered. But, I mean, recently now, just people have just come up just to say thank you. No, tell all your colleagues, you know, we need you now more than ever. There's this kind of a sense of the media being under siege, and people are starting to appreciate what we have media for. And I think that is a promising sign that, first of all, the people are aware of what's going on and they're forming their own opinions about it, and also evaluating what is news in all this debate about fake news, et cetera, what is a reliable source. So I'm optimistic in the long run.
I think if we talk about the undermining of the credibility of the media under Trump, we have to talk about the behavior of the media under Trump. Last time I saw Lynn was January 20th, right after the inauguration, and the story that was across all the airways was that Donald Trump had the bust of Martin Luther King removed from the Oval Office. Mm-hmm. Turns out it was there, and the pool reporter who had said that and tweeted it out just hadn't seen it. If you look at his tweet, I don't know if he deleted it, but the tweet saying that it was removed got about 100 times as many retweets as the tweet saying, oh, my mistake, it was there. That was January 20th, a few hours into the administration. I think basically every day we've gotten a story like that that had to be retracted. My Time magazine had a headline, Olympic athlete Ibtihaj Muhammad was detained because of President Trump's travel ban. Muhammad was detained in December. I don't think President Trump's travel ban had anything to do with that. That was later retracted. You had all sorts of things, a purge of the top Secret Service people that Steve Clemens at The Atlantic tweeted out, totally false. The whole top level senior management at State Department was driven out. It was four people who were kind of mid-top. Every day we see these stories where this is what I was talking about in the beginning. The lack of sobriety is there. So is he leading us on? Well, it's because we run and we publish these stories because of a credulity, because of anger at him attacking us, because the media generally is going to be antipathetic towards Donald Trump for reasons personal and partisan. Whatever reason, the sobriety is not there. And that's the biggest
mistakes, though.
And there are honest mistakes, but if you want to compare the transition and the first month of Trump to the transition and the first month of Obama, I don't think honest mistakes can explain statistically the vast majority, the numbers there. I think if you were to somehow do a thorough counting, it would be there. So there are honest mistakes, but honest mistakes, how do these happen? Because how willing are we to believe something? There's a lot of people out there who are perfectly willing to believe that Barack Obama was born in Kenya or was a Muslim, and the tiniest bit of evidence, they jumped on it because of their predisposition. I think reporters have similar predispositions to believe the worst about Donald Trump, and maybe because the worst about Donald Trump is true, but they go ahead and they believe every report and they don't do the fact-checking, and again, almost every day for the transition in the first month, we saw stories get negative stories about Trump get retracted.
Lynn, I'm curious, do you agree? Are we viscerally, not intended, almost subconscious, are we inclined to be against Trump?
We're in a whole new chapter where we're not against. We have always been against people who don't tell it like it is. Okay, so I think of it in a different way. Whether you're covering local politics or national, you have somebody who doesn't tell it like it is on a repeated, sustained basis, supported by staffers who do the same. So, of course, you're going to look with deep skepticism at everything that Trump says and does because he has he misleads and is a fabulist and causes disagreements on things that should be fact-based, the things that could be data-driven, the number of the popular vote, photos showing different crowd sizes, whether or not a phone was tapped. You know, the examples are abundant, except maybe whether or not Arnold Schwarzenegger ran a good show or not. So even with the predisposition to like or not like somebody, of course, it doesn't take away the responsibility to be right.
Of course not, but is there a predisposition overall?
I'm not going to judge that because I don't want to fall into your trap of that question. What, there is an answer, you could take surveys, you could study it, and the core issue is, are journalists making mistakes they shouldn't? Some are, And it's damaging because the Trump administration won't accept a correction in the way that reporters are used to having it done. We made a mistake.
Let me turn
I shouldn't have done it. That's the issue.
Let me turn the question just a little bit. I think I generally agree with Lynn. I think most reporters generally do a fairly decent job of keeping their biases out of their coverage to the extent that they're aware of it, but we all have instinctive things that we all react. You know, that's just human nature. But Linda Foreman asks whether her problem is essentially that we're too lazy and that maybe...
Wait, say that again.
We're too lazy.
What is the question?
Too lazy. The question is, the perception is that today's journalists accept news furnished to them without due diligence. Can you comment on that perception and how to combat it?
Where's Linda Foreman? Are you talking about local, national? What is... Can you fine-tune that a little bit?
Probably more national.
Oh. I would think there are so many national reporters covering this administration that you have so many places to look for so many kinds of stories that have so many points of view and resources it's not the way you might think it is.
And I just had, there's more young reporters getting sort of more big deal assignments, and the young reporters might be more likely to take what they're fed as opposed to in the past.
Well, one other thing is that we all tend to go into a story with a certain narrative in our heads, and a good professional knows aware of that and screens it out and tries to get beyond that and to be as objective as possible. But very often this happens with candidates and politicians. My favorite example at the moment is Al Gore never actually said he invented the Internet. And I made that mistake in my column one day, and it took about 20 minutes for somebody to email me and say, go back and look at the tape. And I went back, and you could find it on the web, being interviewed by Wolf Blitzer on CNN, as I recall. And he didn't say he invented the Internet, but that came out into the general atmosphere after that interview. As I recall, some conservative commentators had something to do with it, and sort of late-night comedians ran with it like crazy, you know. And then it became part of the common culture, and even Al Gore himself began joking about it. But he never actually said it. And this has happened numerous times over the years. Every campaign I've covered, I've seen this kind of thing happen. I think that sometimes it happens to lean to the left or lean to the right politically, but what's really important here is what is objectivity, what is the legitimate effort, due diligence, if you will, what is an honest mistake, and that's why I emphasize that, because Donald Trump has rewritten the definition of fake news. Now, fake news is any news that makes him look bad or conflicts with mm-hmm. the message he wants to put out. Originally, fake news was news that was deliberately created and put out, unknowingly, putting out false material, and still goes on, of course, every day on the web.
We have time for one more question. I'm going to pose this one myself. Is what we're seeing the wave of the future? My own gut, I'll answer my own question.
Craig?
Is it the wave of the future?
What?
This hostile media attacking, go around the media, just use social media, screw those old guys. I mean, if I knew the honest answer, I'd be the guy who get to pick the new name for a trip company. But my suspicion is, that this is going to filter down all the way down the political chain.
Okay, so Greg says yes. Tim?
I think Donald Trump is one of a kind, and God willing, and we're not going to see something like this again.
Clarence?
I've seen stories about other CEOs looking at it. You know, if he can do it, I can too. I think, though, this has been Donald Trump is a good experience for us. The only thing that makes me nervous is he has the nuclear codes. Outside of that, this is...
I don't know anybody heard what he said. He has nuclear codes.
I'm sorry?
No, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I think, though, that many people are asking now, you know, what did the framers have in mind about this and about that, and what is democracy, what is a representative government, and does Donald Trump's constituency need representation, too, and is he providing it? And that's where Lynn was right, that rubber meets the road.
Okay, Lynn, you get
now
to wrap this up.
The attacks on the press will continue because it's worked for him so well so far with his base. The attacks on the facts will continue. We heard it just recently when Sean Spicer said jokingly that the jobs numbers weren't credible until they are. So you have, this is, we're down, what is the hole that Alice went down? We're down, we're in the rabbit hole, and we're all trying to figure out what to do on it. But the seriousness of this, I think, should not be, this is a serious situation. But I don't think it's repeatable for other political figures. Okay, can you imagine Rauner or Rahm trying to pull that here with the strong journalistic tradition of the Trib, the Sun-Times, and the other outlets in this town? It takes this extraordinary figure, like Trump, maybe once in a career, just like Obama, for many of us, will be once in a career to find somebody who is able to put that together.
Yeah, but I see them both using Twitter more all the time.
Well, and everybody uses the social media that is at their disposal.
Okay, I hate to cut into this conversation because we could go on forever, but we're time-bound. So I'd like to thank Tim Carney, Clarence Page, Lynn Sweet, Greg Hines, everybody who asked those questions.